Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest scandal on Wall Street, the $2 to $3 billion bad bet that JP Morgan Chase made, which has forced the CEO, Jamie Dimon, to admit his previous dismissal of concerns about the bank's trading practices were dead wrong. Sue Craig, who covers JP Morgan Chase and other big banks for the Wall Street Journal and is now with the New York Times, joins us. Then, with Greece in a political crisis and unable to form a government, we'll examine the possibility of a Greek default and exit from the euro with Dimitri Papadimitriou, the president of the Levy Economics Institute. We'll discuss the growing likelihood of a cascading crisis in the eurozone with Greece teetering and increasing doubts about the solvency of Spanish banks, likely to have an impact on the US elections if the European Central Bank can't kick the can down the road before November. Then finally, we will speak with Dr. Obari Hendricks, a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and the author of the new book, The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. We will discuss the impact of President Obama's recent acceptance of same-sex marriage in the Black Church and the broader African American community. I'm now speaking with Sue Craig, who's a reporter who covers Wall Street for the New York Times and previously covered the big Wall Street banks and the bankers with the Wall Street Journal for a decade. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sue Craig.
Hey, thanks for having me, Ian.
And this mea culpa on the part of Jamie Dimon on the Sunday morning talk shows, he's been one of the most aggressive in terms of dismissing Wall Street regulators, and he's even personally gone after Volcker himself in a rather disdainful way. What did you make of his mea culpa in a saying that he was dead wrong back in April when he dismissed concerns over the bank's trading practices?
Well, I thought it was interesting because he definitely struck a different tone on some of the talk shows this morning, notably Meet the Press, where he said that he does agree with a lot of the reforms and sort of went to a length to sort of, I guess, just rebalance what he's been saying towards a more positive, because he has been one of the most vocal critics of the financial reform. And this really just couldn't have happened at a worse time for him in terms of his, you know, his lobbying to get this stuff changed. But I think it also just highlights, you know, the need for these reforms coming out of the financial crisis.
Well, haven't we seen this movie before where trading gets out of hand, in this case, a small unit based in London, and a single trader, apparently a Frenchman, Bruno Michel Iskill, nicknamed the London Whale. AIG? I mean, isn't this a pattern?
We've seen this movie so many times before. I mean, we saw it with, you know, MF Global in terms of them taking outsized risks that ended up, you know, throwing the firm into bankruptcy at the end of 2011. UBS last year had a trading blow up. And I think the misconception here is that these firms do take risk and you can hedge it, but risk is risk and it can go the other way on you. And if the positions are too big or too concentrated, you run into danger. I mean, hedging isn't necessarily something that's going to take the risk out of it. It's a risk in itself, and it can go the wrong way on you. And in this case, you know, there is a lot of questions currently in the market about was this all hedging, or was some of it a proprietary position where the firm, in addition to doing some hedging, was taking a proprietary bet itself on the direction of the markets, you know, which under Volcker would not be allowed.
So, what is Volcker a sufficient firewall between this ambiguity that you just mentioned between hedging and taking risky bets?
I think that's a good question, and I think you have to have something. I think it's a start, and I think it's going to be I still think a work in progress going forward. I mean, there's market making is something that they're looking at, where, you know, market making, In one sense, is sort of a firm may put up capital to facilitate a trade, but at a certain point, it may become a proprietary position if, in doing that, they end up buying a position on their books and then holding it for, you know, some of the current legislation suggests a time period, let's say 60 days. If they hold it for more than 60 days, it becomes a proprietary position, and then and then what happens? I mean, it could go away from them. They could lose money on it. I mean, the problem is the complexity of this, but I think in this case, it may be complex, and it also may have been out of balance in terms of some of the upcoming legislation.
Again, I'm speaking with Sue Crate, who covered J.P. Morgan Chase and other big Wall Street banks for the Wall Street Journal, is now with the New York Times. The fact that the J.P. Morgan Chase lost 10% of its bank stock price, is that what kind of hit would you characterize that as?
Well, I think that's a symbolic hit. I mean, the trade itself, the $2 billion is a huge number looked at in relation, though, to sort of the size of bank J.P. Morgan is. It's significant, but not, you know, huge. But what the market cap decline represent, I think, was just a concern in the market that these institutions, even ones like J.P. Morgan Chase, which are supposed to be some of the best risk takers on Wall Street, can get it wrong. And it just shows that the system, no matter what lawmakers do, there's still the potential for these huge institutions to take these sort of positions that can cost, you know, billions of dollars in this case, and that they're risky, and that there's a larger embedded risk out there. And if they can get it wrong, you know, who else can get it wrong? And I think that's why the stock fell so dramatically on Friday.
Well, isn't there still a possibility of not so much another smoking gun, but more smoke from the gun that was already fired? Isn't there a possibility of at least another billion shoe dropping?
Well, everybody now knows sort of what the position is, and a lot of hedge funds have been betting against them. It's going to be very difficult for them to get out of this position without further losses. I mean, I think that's part of it, but I think that the stock market drop was not so much sort of what the specific trade of and the further losses. I think it's just a concern that these institutions are still very risky, even though they have reduced their leverage since the financial crisis, and we're trying to get legislation in place to sort of stop this kind of behavior that, by its, even by hedging, which is allowed, you know, and if that's what it is, if you're assuming that, and there may be more to it, but even hedging is still a very risky business. And regardless of what happened here, it's still, you know, it is a risky business. And I think people are starting to sort of, there was a lot of nervousness in the market Friday about that because of that reason.
So do you think that Jamie Dimon's appearance on the Sunday talk shows, where he went out of his way to reverse his anti-regulation reputation, and saying that now he backs 70% or so of the Dodd-Frank bill that previously he had castigated? Of course, it's worth mentioning here that J.P. Morgan Chase received $25 billion in TARP funds in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. What kind of come-to-Jesus moment would you characterize this as?
Well, I think it's definitely a humbling moment for him. I mean, I think he's for 70, but he's still against 30% of it. But I think more importantly, this was, you know, he has been hailed as sort of one of the heroes coming out of the financial crisis. J.P. Morgan did very well. And, you know, he has a certain, you know, swagger in his walk and the way that the bank behaves, that they, you know, they didn't cause it. They didn't make these investments that brought down firms like Lehman Brothers. And, in fact, they bought J.P. Morgan coming, you know, as it was going into a crisis. I just think it's a reminder to everybody that these things can happen. And I think to him, I think it's a, you know, it is a humbling point, and I think it's, you know, potentially just a changing point in terms of his legacy on Wall Street.
Well, Sue Craigie seems to have gravitated a tiny bit from the 1% towards the 99% in saying that he does believe, he does want America to be a more equitable society, and he wouldn't mind paying higher taxes.
He said that, actually. It was interesting. He said that that part of the interview was taped Wednesday before he announced the I think it was taped either Wednesday or Thursday, but it was a tape before he announced the trading loss. It was interesting. They went back and they retaped the interview. But I mean, I think that I don't think his stance, I think, changed in terms of the post when he redid the interview. I think he saw a much softer view in terms of the regulation, given where he's come out of. I don't think the other part so much in terms of, I never think he's positioned himself as being sort of, you know, embedded in the 1%. I think that he runs a bank that's very much consumer focused, and I identify when I look at the change in stance. I think it was just more softer language in terms of the regulation.
But hasn't J.P. Morgan Chase been one of the big banks, along with Goldman Sachs, who have been gaming the price of oil? I mean, it's forcing the president and the attorney general to make a recent appearance in the White House Rose Garden to castigate the banks and even talk about perhaps some prosecutions, although there have never been any prosecutions from 2008 or from the possibility of you know, too much speculation driving up the price of oil. Some analysts I've spoken to say it may contribute up to 40% of the price of gasoline. So that's not consumer friendly.
No, and I think a lot of things they do necessarily are, but I think they position themselves as sort of as being sort of consumer friendly. I'm not sure what your question is within that, but I mean, I think.
Well, I'm asking you whether in the sense that that you've characterized them as consumer friendly, aren't they also involved with?
I didn't say that. I think they see themselves.
Oh, they see themselves. Sorry,
I don't think his stance on that has changed.
Right.
I think he still sort of is out there. I never think he stood up and said, you know, we're not consumer friendly, and we're not here to cater consumers, and we're just here to make profit. I haven't heard that from him. It may be what they're doing, but I think what changed today is his stance on Dodd-Frank.
I see. So,
talking in language.
So, is there a political angle here in terms of the presidential race, given that Mitt Romney has been pretty outspoken about wanting to get rid of Dodd-Frank?
I mean, I think what this will do, I think more than anything, it hardens the people who are supporting that legislation, and just gave them Exhibit A in terms of why this legislation is needed. And I think that that's sort of what it did to me when I was sort of listening to the conference call when he was walking through the trading losses. It just gives them ammunition in terms of why this was right. And I think going forward, I think it will, you know. I think it will embolden the Democrats in terms of the work that they've done.
So, Craig, you've covered J.P. Morgan Chase and the other big Wall Street banks and the bankers for the Wall Street Journal for a decade, and now you're doing the same with the New York Times. Just in terms of do you think that there is any is a crisis in American capitalism in the sense that there's the one issue that's come up a lot is the too big to fail, and since the 2008 crash and the consolidation of the surviving banks now who control an increasingly large share of the entire economy, now people are saying that they're even too bigger to fail. So that's one question, and the second question is. Are we talking about a form of capitalism that in many ways Mitt Romney exemplifies, and that is the extraction concentration model, where wealth is extracted and not created? And, you know, the old-fashioned American economy used to be about producing products and jobs and wealth. So
I'm not sure of the last question. I mean, I think in terms of Romney, I think, you know, there's probably a view that there's been too much regulation here, but I can't really speak to that. I mean, I don't view it in terms of Democratic and Republican lines. But to your other question, I think that I don't think these institutions are bigger than they were before. I mean, they have been de-risking. They have been sort of moving down their leverage and hoarding more capital. I mean, I think they're inherently safer institutions. But I think the lesson out of this is simply, no matter how much capital they have, or, you know, whether they're working on, you know, 35 or 40 times leverage as Lehman and others were during the crisis, or, you know, 15, 16 times as some of them are now, that they're still, you know, risky institutions. They take risk, and sometimes it can go against you. And I think that's sort of the lesson I would take out of it. And I think from a regulatory point of view, I think you just can't get complacent. And I think we have to keep watching it and sort of with an eye to sort of regulations that can best keep that in check and minimize these sort of incidents.
But as the financialization of our economy grows and Wall Street has a bigger share of the economy or dominates the economy more and more, do you see that as at least as a change from a kind of an economy that produces wealth as opposed to one that extracts wealth? Is that too simplistic?
Well, no, I think over a long period of time, you're correct. I just think in recent years it's changed. I think that we've gone sort of from one model in terms of financial institutions in the last 5 years to one that is less risky, and they're producing far smaller returns, which has changed, you know, the type of shareholders that are holding these stocks. You know, most of these firms are worth more today if they were broken up. in terms of book, the value of their books, and if they were stay together, very few of them are trading above a book value or a breakup value. I mean, versus 5 years ago, pre-financial crisis, when they were trading well above that. So I think that, you know, are we going to towards? I think that's sort of where we're heading now, and I think what we need to guard against is that they get too big. But I mean, capitalism and in terms of Wall Street still takes up a huge percentage of our economy. It employs tens of thousands of people in New York. I'm not sure that's going to change, or we're going back to sort of a railroad-driven economy.
Mm-hmm.
This is sort of here today. It's sort of how we manage them. But I think in the last 5 years, the profile of these banks has changed dramatically.
But is there sufficient self-interest to recognize that the parts might be worth more than the whole, and therefore accept the politically unpalatable idea of perhaps even returning to Glass-Steagall? I know that's not even being discussed, but
I don't think it's going to happen. So
yeah, I see. Well, we're about to talk about what's happening in Greece and Spain and the cascading effect of that may have on our economy. I don't know whether you could care to comment on that, but.
I think that issue is here to stay for, you know, again, I mean, I think we sort of go through ebbs and flows where we're talking about that issue and then it sort of dies down. But not only are the U.S. banks making, you know, they've got a lot tied up in terms of just investments over there in various sectors, and just it's a systemic problem. I was just in Greece doing some reporting for the New York Times, and it's going to be a long time before these countries work their way out of it, and I think some of them are only sort of just going into realizing the problems.
Well, you better believe, I guess, that the White House are crossing their fingers and holding their breath that nothing happens before the elections in terms of the unraveling of Greece or Spain.
I think they're hoping for a very quiet summer.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Sue Craig.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Sue Craig, who covered Wall Street and the Wall Street banks and bankers for the Wall Street Journal for the past decade, and now doing the same with the New York Times. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about whether or not the Greek financial crisis and political crisis and the Spanish bank insolvency could cascade into further troubles for the U.S. economy.
I'll get ready to call, just like Humpty Dumpty. I'm going to fall, and I'm sitting on top of the world. I'm rolling along, yes, rolling along. Don't want any million, I'm getting my share. I've only got one suit, just one, that's all I can wear. A bundle of money.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound.
A mark, a yen,
a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around, that clinking, clanking sound.
Can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dimitri Papadimitriou, who's president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He's testified on a number of occasions in hearings of the U.S. Senate and the House of Representatives, and has also been a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dimitri Papadimitriou.
Thank you very much for having me.
And clearly there's a chance of a default now with Greece. It's been talked about a lot for the last 2 years, but now there are rumblings and from European central bankers that are floating the idea that a default may well happen. And of course, there's this political gridlock where they can't form a government. At this point, it's not clear whether they will form a government. First of all, what's your understanding of the role of this key player here, Alex Tsipras of the new party Syriza, who refuses to join any of the existing coalitions?
Well, you have to understand that this is an opportunity for the left party in Greece to have a real chance of being the kingmaker in terms of the political system in Greece. This is not the ultra-communist party, but it is certainly the left that has been, from the beginning, opposed to the bailout packages, especially the second one. So there is an opportunity, since the signal from the elections have shown that a good number of people are anti the bailout package as it was adopted and passed through the parliament by the technocratic government of Lukas Papadimos. So from his perspective, Mr. Tsipras has the opportunity to now push forward the agenda that he has been has adopted for a number of years, that the memorandum of understanding that comes with the bailout package is not really acceptable. It has given a lot of misery to the Greek people, and therefore, from that perspective, if the government is to be established with his participation, they have to, in some ways, take this as the number one priority. So I would suspect that the president of the republic, Mr. Papoulias, will not be successful, as the early indications show, which means that there will be elections within the next 30 days. And that probably will sit well with Mr. Tsipras, because the latest polls show that his party, the Radical Party of the Left, is gaining more support than he had, that he was possible to muster from the previous election. And therefore, from his perspective, why not go for elections? Why be actually compromising with the parties that brought in and agreed to these austerity measures?
But that of course, is his bottom line, that he, unless those parties renounce what they've done, then he's not going to join them. So this is really laying down his marker, isn't it? The Greek socialist daily paper Ethnos has warned on its front page today that politicians were playing Russian roulette with the country's economy, which is teetering on the brink of default. This is a high-stakes gamble. How much do the Greek people support the idea of taking a kind of reckless plunge in the dark there in terms of defaulting and going back to the drachma?
I think the question that should be asked is whether the Greek people believe that this is sort of the end of Greece's membership to the club of the Eurozone. I think many people see some signs that even the parties that agree to those austerity measures, they're willing to start some renegotiation. And yesterday's report from Mr. Juncker, who is the chairman of the Eurogroup, has indicated that perhaps Greece should be given more time to meet the targets that were established in the bailout plan. Instead of 2 years, perhaps it should be longer. This is some light at the tunnel, which gives some hope to Greek people, and perhaps dealing with politicians, everyone would take advantage of, I said that, I wanted to do this. So every political, I think, system now, every political party, I'm sorry, is interested to take credit for some warm signals that are coming from Brussels or from Berlin. Mr. Tsipras perhaps is overdoing it, but on the other hand, it may be an opportunity for him to either play this high-stakes game and either win or basically go back to where it used to be, a marginal party.
Again, I'm speaking with Dimitri Papadimitriou, who's president of the Levy Economics Institute and the Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. On the other hand, it seems, Dimitri Papadimitriou, that what we hear from Europe and the central banks, I mean, there may be some room to renegotiate and get better terms, And I believe there's a $30 billion payment that's being held up. There's also a lot of rumblings from European central bankers, basically not just accepting the idea of default, but many of them are sort of so exasperated that they might even welcome it, it seems.
Well, it's very difficult to know. You may be right. I think that the European leaders from Berlin and from Brussels and from anywhere else and from Frankfurt wouldn't certainly be acquiescent to this request because it won't stop with Greece. If they do it for Greece, it will come. Portugal will be next and Ireland. And perhaps a different kind of a plan will be given to not only to Spain, but also to the Netherlands as well. So I think that they have to be very, very careful, even though they have said that Greece is a particular case, since it's a very much smaller country. It also, its finances were in total shambles. So it may be that it is a special case. But again, it's very difficult to assume that they will go along with it. So there is a real possibility that Greece actually will leave the euro, especially if the payment is held back. I foresee that the payment won't be held back because the biggest portion, the lion's share of the payment, is basically to retire existing bonds, which are part of the ECB. They are part of the European Financial Stability Facility, as well as some private sector. So I suspect that some portion of the payment will come. It depends if the Greek government will accept a portion and then wait for the other portion that's supposed to be used for the Greek people's expenses, which includes pensions and payments of salaries to the public employees. So we will have to see. But you're right, there is a very high possibility that things will get narrowed and the prospects might lead to ultimately Greece leaving the euro.
Well, it seems, though, in many ways, Dimitri Papadimitriou, that this is generational in Greece. The young, and by the way, there's 54% unemployment amongst the young. They've voted for Tsipras and are supporting his policies, whereas according to Greek polls, the majority of Greeks favor remaining in the euro. So is this what's going on? Is the young people who are facing unemployment have seen these crooked and incompetent governments make all of these bad bets and act in this profligate and irresponsible way, leaving them holding the bag? I mean, it seems to me that this is there's quite a lot of generational anger in this.
Yeah, I don't think that even the young people wished Greece to exit the euro. I think overwhelmingly the Greek people, young, old, and from wherever walks of life, know that leaving the euro would be a catastrophe. But on the other hand, there's a difference between staying in the eurozone and suffering every day on what this appears to be harsh and helpless austerity measures. And there is, you know, the sense that we have in the United States as well, that everything that we do primarily is towards the banking sector and not really to the everyday people. And from that perspective, Mr. Tsipras's pronouncements find resonance with the Greek people. So it's not only the young, and I don't think that there is a choice for the Greek people to actually exit the euro. It's just a question whether it would be possible to stay in the euro if, in fact, there will be no payment and no support that comes outside of paying or repaying the government bonds that have come due. So it's not their choice to leave the euro, and I think even Mr. Tsipras's pronouncements go to pains to say we're not interested in leaving the eurozone. We want to have a different terms and stay in the eurozone. Now, whether this is possible or not is a different question.
Well, Dimitri Papadimitriou, we've spoken in the past over the last couple of years and have both sort of wondered about why it is that the European Union, particularly the central bank and particularly the German political leadership of Europe, since the Germans are the ones that have profited most from the euro, it has been so difficult for them to get their hands around this crisis. And the longer it goes on, the deeper the hole gets. and nothing is more stark than what's happening in Greece today. But you also have to look at what's happening in Spain today, where just on Friday, Spain moved to overhaul its entire banking system, forcing lenders to come up with $40 billion to cover these real estate losses going back to the housing boom that went bust in 2008. There's no new money. Again, there's over 50% unemployment with young Spaniards. I'm beginning to wonder here whether we've mentioned this before over the last couple of years, that in a paradoxical way, Angela Merkel holds Barack Obama's re-election fate in her hands. This is beginning to look like this may well be an unfortunately true omen, that if Greece...
I think you're absolutely right. If the can is not kicked down the road beyond November, I think this will be an important decision for the American people to see what would be the impact on the U.S. economy. Because as we all know, we are in an interconnected global economy. There's a lot of exposure of financial institutions to financial institutions in Europe to the tune of over $1 trillion. So this is not something that we should not take into consideration. And that's how we see the extended swap agreements that the Federal Reserve has extended to European banks, as well as the interest from Secretary Geithner, as well as President Obama. So I think you're absolutely right. My only concern is that when would the Chancellor of Germany will realize that you cannot say that you can cushion yourself, you have cushioned yourself and the rest of the European Union from a Greek default, because a Greek default will have a contagion effect going to Portugal, Ireland, and Spain. And, you know, in addition to the debt, which is over 340 billion euros, there are also interbalances between central banks. The Bank of Greece, which is the central bank of Greece, owes about 108 billion euros to other central banks in the European system. So it is a substantial amount of money. You can come as close to $500 billion. So that's why you hear the pronouncements from Angela Merkel that we do not want Greece to exit the euro. Because it's not only what is being held by the ECB and the European Stability Financial Mechanism, but also what interbalances are, interbank balances are, and what this would mean should Greece exit euro.
But Angela Merkel is facing the same political situation that Sarkozy faced. And of course, France has just moved to the left away from austerity programs. Not that the Germany's not the one that's imposing most of the austerity, but she's facing a dwindling coalition. And at this point, it seems that she's always been motivated by domestic concerns, and they've never really leveled. Have they, the German government, and Merkel's never leveled with the German people? In many ways, they prefer to blame this on cultural issues, that the lazy Catholic countries in the south don't pay their taxes, whereas us, you know, hardworking Protestants pay our taxes. And the long and the short of it is that, for example, the Spanish situation has a lot to do with the housing boom that was entirely to do with Germans buying second homes in Spain. So
that's exactly right. You're absolutely right. And I think that given how the local elections in Germany have turned, I don't think that Angela Merkel has an easy election, re-election next year when she comes up for re-election. So it also derives that German people do not really know enough, other than what has been told to them, about the lazy Greeks, even though both Greeks and the Portuguese people work longer hours than the Germans do. But they're just not as productive as the Germans and people from Holland are, because there's no technology. The diffusion of technology in the production process is minimal, if at all.
But this is a situation where again, if you take the notion that Merkel holds Obama's electoral fate in her hands, if she is constrained from making the bold moves necessary to create a sufficient firewall to stop this thing unraveling, it's going to then cascade onto the American economy, a very weak recovery that's teetering now, and then we'll end up with Mitt Romney. I mean, this ridiculous businessman who thinks he can save America and is against the Dodd-Frank Act, wants to repeal that. The very thing that we've just seen the dire need for with J.P. Morgan losing $3 billion.
Right, right. You're absolutely correct. But, you know, the ordinary folks that don't have a job and they have been long-term unemployed, and we have very many of them in the United States, with an unemployment rate that it is an underemployment rate, which translates to 20 million people. This isn't easy, and the pronouncements from someone who says that I know how to run business and therefore I know how to run a country, there's some appeal to it. Quite unfortunate for it, but on the other hand, people want to latch on to something that's optimistic. And Mr. Obama, no matter how he has tried and what he has done, and he has done a lot, it still has left a lot of people behind.
So, Dmitry, are you suggesting here that my pessimism is justified, that Romney could win because the president will be a victim of these forces outside of the country that he can't control?
Well, I hope you're wrong, but on the other hand, I cannot say definitively that the possibility is not for extremely tight race, where perhaps Mr. Romney might actually win. Of course, we do have 6 months more to go, and therefore many things can happen between now and then. And I'm optimistic that something will happen to the extent that people will see that the better bet will be in favor of Mr. President Obama than candidate Romney.
Well, just in closing, though, Dmitry, the longer the time frame is, you know, obviously what the White House is sweating bullets here, hoping that they, as you, to use your analogy, that they can, the Europeans can kick the can down the road so that the international economy doesn't unravel before November. In the meantime, what kind of narrative is the president going to come up with? He can't keep telling everybody that he killed bin Laden and that he allows gay marriage. He's got to come up with a narrative here, hasn't he?
Yes, of course. And the expectation is that he will have provided some relief with the suspension of the payroll tax. And one doesn't know between now and November what other policies can be implemented. Certainly, he's talking about jobs. He's talking about his concern. And he probably, being a good politician, he will blame the Republicans. And I think they should be blamed because basically they have made it their goal to unseat him. So I wouldn't be surprised if he actually becomes much stronger in his attacks towards that.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Dmitry Papadimitriou.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dmitry Papadimitriou, president of the Levy Economics Institute and Jerome Levy Professor of Economics at Bard College. He's testified on a number of occasions before the committees of the Senate and the House and was vice chairman of the Trade Deficit Review Commission of the U.S. Congress and a member of the Competitive Policy Council Subcouncil on Capital Allocation. He was also a distinguished scholar at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with theologian Aubrey Hendricks about how the president's support for same-sex marriage will play in the African-American community. Be constructive.
Swing low. coming for to carry me.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, a visiting scholar in religion and African American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary. He previously was president of Payne Theological Seminary, the oldest African American theological seminary in the United States, and is the author of The Politics of Jesus, Rediscovering the True Revolutionary Natures of Jesus' Teachings and How They Have Been Corrupted. And his latest book, just out, is The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Aubrey Hendricks.
Good to be with you, Brother Matt.
And Governor Romney spoke at the Liberty University, Jerry Falwell's Bible College, where he spoke obliquely about his Mormon faith. And I'd like to talk to you about some of the research you've done on Romney's Mormon faith. But the biggest cheer, in fact, the only cheer that Romney got from the kids and parents graduating it from Liberty University was over his opposing and President Obama's recent acceptance of same-sex marriage. Interestingly, though, the parents were interviewed by the media, and they, of course, were very happy to hear Romney distance himself from President Obama's recent conversion, if you will. But the kids weren't that enthusiastic. So even within the conservative evangelical community, there seems to be a generational shift.
Yes. Well, you know, I think that because the young people aren't as culturally traditional, you know, as I guess is the case with each succeeding generation, generally, you know, their attitude would be different. But I think that young people are less concerned with doctrine than they are with humanity. And with regard to their Christian faith, you know, many of them are more concerned with the love ethic of Jesus than the punitive, exclusionary ethic of the religious right.
So do you think then that the president should, I mean, first of all, it sounds like his struggle of accepting same-sex marriage was a kind of struggle between the heart and the head. He always was predisposed to be sympathetic and supportive. However, his political handlers were saying, you know, it's going to cost you votes. But it seems that it's actually not had the repercussions that the pundits have predicted. If anything, it's put Romney on the defensive. What's your reading on it?
Yeah, I think that that's the case because people are getting more and more tired of the divisiveness. And I think that the right wing did themselves a great strategic disservice by the vociferousness and the mean-spiritedness of their discourse, and almost in a way dehumanizing same gender loving people. And you know, folks are just tired of that kind of hateful stuff. On the other hand, President Obama said, look, these are human beings I've come to know. I can't just turn my back on folk who love each other, and all they want is the same rights and recognition as everybody else. So I think that his tone is really the winning tone, particularly for young people.
But surely, I think you could be more specific there, don't you think, the president, in terms of what's of putting this issue in the broader issue of whether or not you're for increasing rights in America or rolling them back. And you just noticed in North Carolina, which, by the way, the preamble to its constitution says all men are created equal. But here they are just a week ago turning back the clock. And frankly, it smacks more of Jim Crow than it does of the theology of the religious right.
Yeah. Well, with regard to your latter statement, I think the Tea Party. Well, I think there are a couple things happening. I think that with the election of a black president has freed many, has caused many people to not be able to hold back.
the various prejudices. And when people started attacking the president, trying to delegitimate the president and all but dehumanize him, you know, I think it freed them to come out with their other biases as well. As far as the president making a harder and a bigger strike for constitutional rights, you know, I can't see him doing that strategically before the election. He's out on a limb now, you know, having gone as far as he's gone, I think.
Well, we just were speaking with a specialist on the European economy, and you know, there are certain things out there that are beyond the president's control that could affect his re-election chances, particularly if the Greeks default and Spanish banks go under, and it has a cascading effect over here. This election may rest on economic literacy in this country, of which there is unfortunately not very much.
Yeah, because I don't think that the president lost many votes. I mean, the folks who were against Obama were generally against marriage equality anyway. And what I'm saying is I don't think he's going to lose too many votes anyway. The people who are against him are still against him.
Well, but your book, your new book, Dr. Herbie Hendricks, The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic, is in many ways a call for a revival, if you will, of the religious left as opposed to the religious right, in the sense that the religious right has usurped the Bible. They've taken the patriotic high ground, and there's been a kind of defensiveness on the part of what could be loosely called the religious left. But the difference is that the people on the religious left actually have the Bible on their side. Jesus did not, the prophet, did not carry an AK-47 or assault rifle, didn't hate homosexuals, didn't celebrate capital punishment, and didn't go on television shaking poor people down for money. So I've never understood why the so-called or somewhat absent religious left has not been more aggressive in allowing the religious right to confiscate and usurp the Bible.
You're absolutely right. I mean, they act like the Bible is theirs, and their reading of it is the only legitimate one. And yes, we on the left have allowed that to happen. I think some of it was in reaction to the some people on the left didn't want to seem like fundamentalist zealots on the right, or, you know, some mixture of that. But I think we're starting to. I've been talking to some religious scholars. Actually, I was with about 90 at a meeting last week, in which we're talking about we have to come back and really not just reinterpret, but to present the truth and to remove the distortions. Biblical distortions that the religious right are offering as biblical truth. I mean, for instance, if I might give you just a couple, you have this libertarian, it's Christian to have small government, and that's not true. It's, what the Bible says, the biblical thing, the Bible talks about the responsibilities of government. Government should take care of the poor and the weak, and the vulnerable. And so the optimal size of government is the government that can take care, that can fulfill its responsibilities to the people. That's just one example. With regard to the homosexuality, though, and gay marriage, if I might, we see a number of places. We see in Leviticus, it says that if a man lies with a man, he should be killed. But it also says if a child disrespects a parent, that child should be killed. And there are other things that they say, other primitive type things that we see there. And what's not said, and it also says that if you masturbate, if you spill your seed on the ground, you should be killed. And what is missing here that the religious right does not provide is context. These things were if they are divine disclosures, they were given to a very primitive people, a small tribe of primitive people who were trying to survive in the village. They're beleaguered at every side. The Bible shows that they were the only one of the only tribes that did not have a king. So every every king's trying to conquer them. And so if you look at it in those terms, not procreating is almost like killing the tribe. I mean, so you must be fruitful and multiply. And if you have relations with a man instead of a woman, well, then there will not be a child coming out of that to be a warrior or to be a worker to help build up the stock of the tribe. And the same with masturbation. If you masturbate, if you spill that seed, that's a seed that could not turn into a child and into a member of that society. So you see what I'm saying? These things have to be put in context, and we can't just cherry pick. And that's what the religious right does. They do not ever give the context. They'll take a thing and then they'll use it to buttress their own thoughts and opinions and policies.
Yeah, but they assiduously avoid the Beatitudes and the parts of the New Testament that really reflect who the prophet Jesus was and what he believed in and what he was telling his followers to follow.
Well, there are a couple things with that. First, you're absolutely right, but you called him the prophet Jesus, and he was, the New Testament says he was the Messiah and the Son of God, but it also, Luke calls him a prophet, mighty in word and deed. And what did the prophets do? The prophets spoke truth to power. The prophets were the first ones in recorded history that we, well, in Middle Eastern history anyway, what we call the Middle East, who stood up and said, no, there's no divine right of kings. Everyone has the same right to be our right. It was egalitarian. So Jesus is egalitarian in that sense. And there's when you talk about the Beatitudes and love, this is what I'd like to pose. And if you have two people who go to Jesus and they say, look, Savior, we love one another. We want to commit our lives to one another in faithfulness and fidelity. We want to consecrate it in the eyesight of God. Savior, would you give us your blessing? Now, those of us who read the gospel know that Jesus, what's he going to say? Yes, of course. Am I right?
Sure, no matter who they are, whether they're man and a woman, and a man.
Yes, I mean, what's he going to say? No, well, I know you love each other and you want to dedicate your lives, but God didn't make Adam and Steve. God made Adam and Eve. No, he's not going to say that. He's going to say, bless you and be faithful and love one another. Well, if Jesus that we know would do that, then how can anybody else who calls themselves a Christian claim that they have the right to do anything more unless they think they're holier than the Jesus that they worship?
Well, again, I'm speaking with Dr. Aubrey Hendricks, visiting scholar in religion and African-American studies at Columbia University, and professor of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of the new book, The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. So tell us about the fallout then of the president's recent acceptance of same-sex marriage in the black church and in the broader African-American community. Because out here in California, Dr. Hendricks, 58% of African-Americans voted for Proposition 8 that banned gay marriage.
Yeah. Well, it's tragic. And, the black community is socially always been conservative, but I think in the case of California, it's different than the rest of the country. In the case of California, there was such a large push by those with great deal of money.
The Mormon Church, I might add.
Well, yeah, the Mormon Church, exactly. Pushing this, disseminating their information and misinformation. There were ministers who were, let's just say, that they were shown very special comforts to support this, and I think really that the ministers were snookered, and they snookered the people. But in general, you know, black people because it's socially conservative, you know, there's some reticence about homosexuality, but it's not a mean-spirited. African-American churches have not been mean-spirited. They've been open and loving. There are gay people throughout the church, and I think that we're going to see a sort of a we've seen some surprise from black ministers, but I don't think that most black Christians are going to be upset with President Obama, and even if they disagree with that one point, they do agree with his populism. I certainly do. I do believe so. I don't think it's going to hurt him, the African American community. It might even strengthen him because it's shown him to be a man of real conviction.
Well, conversely, Mitt Romney, again, who spoke yesterday at Jerry Falwell's Liberty University, he did mention differences between his faith and the evangelical Christian right, which you know, he's obviously trying to woo them you know, close the deal, if you will. You've written, Dr. Obi Hendricks, about Mitt Romney's religion, the Book of Mormon, where it is absolutely unequivocally hostile to black people. It says that black people are cursed, and not only are they cursed, they're lazy and aesthetically ugly to boot. And of course, Mitt Romney has talked about how the church changed in 1978, and now allows the uncursed to participate, that is, only males in the priesthood and the sacred temple ceremonies. But you point out in your article that that revelation from the living prophet of the church conveniently appeared when the church's federal tax-exempt status was imperiled by racial politics. Do you think he's going to have his a real discussion about his religion? Because he talks a lot about how his father walked out of the 64 Republican Convention in protest against the Republican Party's racial politics, and it worked with Martin Luther King, etc. But Romney himself has never shown any activism in terms of civil rights. So, do you think he's going to, really come clean about the church, and we're going to have a debate about their theology?
Oh no! He's Mitt Romney's a hollow man. He's a man of really. I mean, other than the doctrines the orthodox doctrines of his church, he seems to be a man of not hard conviction. With regard to the Mormon church, after I wrote that article, I heard from many Mormons, black and white. Of course, many were angered, but many black and white, and more white, wrote me and said, what you must talk about is the terrible racism in the Mormon church today. And of course, we know that a church that held blacks as second-class citizens until just 20, 30 years ago is, you know, there are going to be residues of that.
Sure.
But white Christians are the most racist people in America. You know, so.
Well, look, I'd hate to cut you off, but we've run out of time here, Dr. Obi Hendricks, and I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Obi Hendricks, visiting scholar in religion and African-American studies at Columbia University and professor of biblical interpretation at New York Theological Seminary. He's the author of the new book, The Universe Bends Towards Justice, Radical Reflections on the Bible, the Church, and the Body Politic. This has been Background Briefing. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.